Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The year-end holiday season is traditionally a big time for movies. This year, with all the troubles outside the theater, we may be glad to be in it. And Hollywood is laying out a big spread. Here's Beyoncé Knowles in Cadillac Records playing blues legend Etta James, who doesn't want to sing.
I ain't a shy fool.
It's just hard to do if you ain't in the mood. And I ain't in the mood.
Oh, but she gets in the mood. Tom Cruise plays a Nazi colonel plotting to assassinate the Führer, Adolf Hitler.
I serve my country. But I have betrayed my conscience. We need to kill Hitler. There has to be a chance of success.
Not much German accent there. Meryl Streep plays one angry nun. Clint Eastwood is back for the last time, he says. Brad Pitt turns into a baby. This hour On Point, we'll look at what Hollywood's rolling out for the holidays. You can join the conversation. What have you seen? What are you waiting for? Have you caught Slumdog Millionaire, Australia? Are you ready for 7 Pounds, Will Smith, Frost, Nixon? We've got a couple of great movie mavens with us today. From Pasadena, California, Claudia Puig joins us. She's film critic for USA Today. Claudia, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And with me in the studio is Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe. Ty, wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
Let's jump right in. We've got all kinds of clips we're going to listen. Some may have seen Slumdog Millionaire already. I know it's got raving fans out there. Let's listen to just a little scene from British filmmaker Danny Boyle's film. An impoverished Indian teen here named Jamal Malik Dev Patel got himself onto an Indian TV version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, not because he wants the prize money, but because he's trying to prove his love. Here, stumped by a question, Jamal asks for a lifeline, calls, well, a girlfriend. There's an excruciating wait as her phone rings. We cut out a lot of the rings here to save time. He's just about to lose the point when she finally picks up the phone.
In Alexander Dumas' book, The Three Musketeers, two of the musketeers are called Athos and Porthos. What was the name of the third musketeer?
I'd like to phone a friend.
Here we go.
Hello?
And Slumdog Millionaire is off and running. Here we go. Claudia Puig, this one's already in the theaters. We'll talk about a lot that are not, but what is it that's getting such rave response from the people who go for Slumdog Millionaire?
It's just a great movie. It's so visually dazzling. It has an exhilarating feel to it. Danny Boyle is the director who made such a splash a while ago with Trainspotting and who has made several good and mediocre movies since then. But this is just his best effort since Trainspotting. It's kind of kaleidoscopic looking. It's got a great score. It's got great cinematography. And the story is so heartfelt. It's kind of a Dickensian sort of story of, you know, this boy who we just heard, Jamal, and his brother and everything they go through on the streets of Mumbai. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what he eventually, you know, gets on this Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And the performances are great. The guy who plays the host, Anil Kapoor, is great. He's interrogated later by police. Detective who is also excellent. He was in The Namesake, Irfan Khan, and Dev Patel himself is very good. It's a beautiful movie.
And of course, Mumbai all over the news since this came out for the terror attacks at the Taj Mahal Motel and a hotel and all the rest. Motel hardly. Ty Burr, is this the future? I mean, here we have a British director, a setting in India with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, so famous in the United States but started in the UK. Mm-hmm. You know, are boundaries going away?
Boundaries are going. I hope this is the future of pop
filmmaking. I mean, this is one of these movies. People ask me, you know, I'm a film critic. People say, you know, what should I see? They don't make them like they used to. Well, here's a movie that is made like they used to. You know, Claudia's right to bring up Dickens. It has that kind of scope. You get this kid's entire life, and really, the last 30 years, last 20 years of Mumbai, as seen through the lens of this game show, and it goes back and forth in time. It's made with terrific energy, with terrific spirits.
A tearjerker, an inspirational.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the bones of the movie, it's corny as heck. I mean, it's like an old fashioned Hollywood movie, just with a third of it is in Hindi and there are no stars, and so it's kind of a tough sell. But everybody I've told to go see it, including people who don't normally go to the movies, I say go see this movie. They come back and they say, "My God, that's the best movie I've seen in ages."
Slumdog Millionaire out already. Valkyrie with Tom Cruise out, I believe, on Christmas Day or Christmas Day,
that's right.
Night, something like this, directed by Bryan Singer. Talk about an old-fashioned theme. Tom Cruise as German army officer Klaus von Stauffenberg, leader of a plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler.
I serve my country, but I have betrayed my conscience. We need to kill Hitler. There has to be a chance of success.
That's why you're here.
Any problem on Earth can be solved with the careful application of explosives.
But remember, nothing ever goes according to plan.
From Valkyrie with Tom Cruise. Now, we've seen the posters of Tom Cruise in that, that like scary, spiffy SS Nazi officer uniform, especially after some of the videos he's been in. It's particularly spooky, but he's the anti-Hitler crowd here in this film, Claudia.
Yes. Yes, of course. I mean, you don't really, I guess you don't make a whole lot of points being with the pro-Hitler crowd.
No.
But
though he looks, he's all dressed up for Nazism.
Yeah, this is the biggest problem with this movie is what you just heard and the fact that he doesn't even make the remotest attempt to do a German accent, not even a British accent, not anything that sounds other than what we're used to hearing.
Tom Cruise is bigger than Germany.
Yeah, that's what it feels like, you know, and that there's so many great people around him. He's got Tom Wilkinson. He's got Kenneth Branagh. He's got
Bill Nighy,
who's fantastic. Yeah, he's got these great, great, the best of the British actors. And then in the beginning voiceover, you hear him speaking German. You go, I don't speak German, so it sounded good to me. It sounded like a person who could master the language. He doesn't. Why didn't he spend some time with a dialect coach? That's all I could think the entire movie. It took me out of the movie to hear him speaking with this American accent.
What do you think, Ty? Tom Cruise, Nazi, trying to take down Hitler.
Well, this is a movie that had disaster written all over it. People were ready to jump all over it and just, beat Tom Cruise for being a movie star, in a historical fiction, a very unusual and pointed historical fiction. I have to say, it works as a Hollywood, quote, entertainment, unquote. And I think that's what Tom Cruise does. And I have to say that the accent thing didn't really bother me in the watching of it. It's a perfectly fine suspense thriller if you take into account the fact that you know how it's going to turn out. And they work overtime to put up, datelines, 3:37 p.m. Munich. They kind of go overboard on that. It's Mission Impossible in the most realistic sense. But it's not a Lives of Others kind of movie. It's not one of these independent foreign language films that you go and you really get layers of complicity and meaning. It's a Hollywood movie. And I think if you go into it expecting that, it's okay.
Mission Impossible with very shiny boots in Valkyrie with Tom Cruise. Then there's The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, another big star out there, Brad Pitt, David Fincher's new film adapted from an F. Scott Fitzgerald story about a man born in his 80s who ages backwards. He's born in New Orleans at the end of World War I. Here in this scene, an old Benjamin Button, played by Brad Pitt, sits under a table and talks with his newfound friend, a young girl, Daisy, who later becomes his life love, played later by Cate Blanchett.
I'm not as old as I look.
I thought so. You don't seem like an old person.
Like my grandma.
I'm not.
Are you sick?
Well, I heard Mama and Dizzy whisper, and they said I was going to die soon, but maybe not.
You're odd. You're different than anybody I've ever met.
Maybe not. Brad Pitt sounds a little like Forrest Gump there.
Forrest Gump, yes.
Well,
yes.
Interestingly enough, the screenplay is by Eric Roth, who wrote Forrest Gump.
Okay.
And this
is it one of those kind of surreal saga stories?
Well, it covers the man's entire life from birth to death, and in this case, from old age to youth. And if David Fincher, who directed it, is a great director. He made Seven. He made Zodiac, which was one of the great films of last year.
Mm-hmm.
This is his least David Finchery movie. If anything, it belongs more to Eric Roth. The problem I had with it is that, unlike Forrest Gump, which love it or hate it, deals with history and culture and, you know, one man's passage through, you know, 30 years of major events, this film, you really don't get a sense of what's going on outside the central relationship between Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out of it saying, well, what's the point? What's the message? What am I coming out of here with? It's a very well-made film that feels hermetically sealed.
Claudia, what do you think? Is Todd just missing something here?
No, I agree completely, and I'm really happy to hear him say that because some people have loved this movie, and I don't get why. There is one sort of contextual scene, and that was this scene where he and Cate Blanchett have like the Beatles in the background, you know, like they're on Ed Sullivan or something like that. And then you really feel like it's Forrest Gump because it's like the Elvis Presley thing.
Interestingly, in that scene, I wanted to know what Benjamin Button thought of the Beatles. This was something brand new.
A guy born in World War I, crossing with his love in mid-century.
He just sort of dances around the room with Cate Blanchett, but you never get a sense of what he thinks about things.
You don't get a sense of who he is, ever, really. I mean, you know, that's the biggest problem with it. And I agree with you about David Fincher. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. I thought Zodiac was one of the best movies of whatever year that was, last year, year before. But this one just doesn't make it.
High concept in the Benjamin Button there, and Brad Pitt to boot. Cate Blanchett, great, but maybe not a full hit. We'll look at many more. Claudia Puig, please stand by, and Ty Boer will go out with some music from Australia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the movies and what Hollywood's rolling out for the holidays. Ty Boer is with us, film critic for the Boston Globe, author of the 100 Greatest Movies of All Time. Claudia Puig is with us, film reviewer for USA Today. She joins us from Pasadena, California. Gus Van Sant's Milk tells the story of San Francisco politician Harvey Milk. In 1977, Milk was elected to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, the first openly gay man to be elected to public office in the country, I think. In this scene, Sean Penn, playing Milk, fires up a crowd.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you. On the Declaration of Independence, it is written, all men are created equal. No matter how hard you try, you can never erase those words.
Sean Penn really going at it as Harvey Milk there, and of course very prominent since the Prop 8 vote in California and much else. Ty, is there a theme to the movies? There are a lot of them being rolled out at this year's end. Is there a trend, a theme, is there anything you can say? There are so many. They're all over the place, I guess.
I think that if there's a trend to the year's end movies, it's heaviosity. It's important issues, which is why something like Slumdog Millionaire sticks out in that it's different. It just wants to tell a great story.
Heaviosity, because they're gunning for Oscars around the corner?
They're gunning for Oscars. This is also has become the time of year where any movie that has anything to say beyond entertaining us silly, this is when it comes out. So it's kind of a traffic jam of white elephant movies, you know, some of which work, some of which don't. Milk, I think, works beautifully. I think this is one of my favorite movies of the year because it tells the story cleanly, clearly, and Sean Penn, for once, seems to get off his soapbox, even though Harvey Milk gets on his, and give us the full man.
Let's go to listeners on Milk. Daniel in Somerville. You're on the air, Daniel.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi.
Just saw Milk a couple of days ago. I actually teach a class in movies at Cambridge Center for Adult Ed.
Great.
So I spent a session on it last night, and I thought it was the most emotionally affecting film I've seen in literally maybe my entire lifetime.
Wow. As a political piece of work, as a piece of theater?
Just purely emotional. I mean, I felt like the entire movie was as emotionally affecting as the end of It's a Wonderful Life, when James Stewart gets back to reality and there's all sorts of affirmation and spirituality. I just felt that there was such pain and beauty. It was a surpassing film, and also a cogent, coherent biopic, which mm-hmm. is a very rare thing. So I was amazed yesterday when the Golden Globes didn't nominate it. And I wondered if that was possibly, maybe this is a stretch, but it's possibly a little bit of homophobia because, you know, similarly, Brokeback Mountain lost the Oscar to the mediocre Crash a couple of years ago.
That's a fascinating question.
It's an interesting little trend among award givers.
Daniel, let me ask you first, watching the film, Milk, did you have to be on the gay rights bandwagon to be gung-ho for it or affecting right across all lines?
Well, it hasn't been one of my major political thrusts in my life.
And it swept you away even so.
It is a subject that I think hits me right in the heart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right from the first shot of those poor middle-aged gay men hiding in the bar from the footage from the early 60s or late 50s. I thought it just is a very natural theme for most people to get behind.
Got it. Claudia, why no Golden Globe? It certainly got a lot of attention.
Yes, and Sean Penn did get nominated, though, didn't he?
He did.
And as did Josh Brolin.
That's right, for Best Actor.
That would have been a complete travesty if he hadn't.
I don't think Brolin did.
Was it Leonardo DiCaprio, Frank, for Revolutionary Road?
For Supporting.
He's gotten some Critics Circles nominations.
Brad Pitt,
maybe it was,
Mickey Rourke, Franklin Gallant. But the film itself?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the Golden Globes, I mean, don't get me started on the Golden Globes, the people behind the Golden Globes, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, you know, people aren't exactly sure who they are, and a lot of them are not critics or really journalists. They're kind of, you know, you can work for the Slovakia Times something. I mean, just really small. That's probably would be too big. You could work for a really, really small foreign publication and be in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, something's overlooked, it's not as egregious as if it's overlooked by the Academy in terms of, you know, who this organization is. But he's absolutely right. It shouldn't have been overlooked.
Homophobia, Ty, do you see that?
I think two things are going on here as relates to the Golden Globes. One, it's a very American story. You know, and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association gave nominations to In Bruges and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, anything with a European mm-hmm. place name in the title.
Right.
I also think this is a movie that is out, that is proudly out from the opening scene where, you know, Harvey Milk picks up a guy in the subway who becomes his, you know, long-term lover. This is a movie that is not about the closet. It's well out of the closet. And if that you have a problem with that, so I think homophobia does come into play.
Could. Yeah. You're talking about heaviosity.
It could.
We'll suspend judgment right there, but the question mark hangs in the air. Heaviosity goes surely with doubt. I've only seen the trailer, but this movie, Doubt, takes place in a Catholic school in the Bronx, 1964. Sister Aloysius Bouvier, played by Meryl Streep, suspects the charismatic new priest, Father Brendan Flynn, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, of having an unhealthy interest in a new boy. She's got no proof, only her moral certainty. Here, Sister Aloysius and a young nun, Sister James, played by Amy Adams, visit Father Brendan to discuss how to perk up the Christmas pageant a little.
Well, I think it's an excellent idea to rethink the Christmas pageant. So last year's effort was a little woebegone.
Oh, I loved it. But I love all pageants, the hymns. Oh, little town of Bethlehem. Oh, come, O come, Emmanuel. O come,
all
O
right.
faithful.
Thank you, Sister James. So what do you think, Father? Is there something new we could do?
Well, we all love the Christmas hymns. But it might be jolly to include a secular song.
Secular?
Yes, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, something like that.
What would be the point of a secular song?
It's fun.
Or Frosty the Snowman.
That's a good one. We could have one of the boys dress up as a snowman, dance around.
Which boy?
Meryl Streep, scary, stern, in Doubt, there with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Claudia Puig, I mean, I've only seen the trailer, and talk about it looks pretty heavy. Meryl Streep is the bad nun here, the way it's portrayed, you know, pushing back against some of the tide of history. And yet we know about the pedophilia scandal to come as we watch this film. It's interesting.
We do, and that It is interesting. And I think we can't look at it in any way but through that lens. So that, of course, colors our sense of what happened here. But if you've seen the play, which a lot of people have, and it's a fantastic play, won the Pulitzer and everything, this adheres very closely to it and yet also takes full advantage of, you know, the genre of the film genre by blowing it out a little bit and amplifying it and contextualizing it, which I think is a wise thing. Meryl Streep is a complicated person. They're all complex characters because she seems like the bad nun. She's unpleasant. She's autocratic, but she may or may not be right. But it's not as simple as she's just this, you know, kind of slapstick evil nun who slaps kids around type of thing or wraps them with. And also Philip Seymour Hoffman comes across as the priest comes across as very likable, congenial, open-minded, but he may in fact be a pedophile.
Right.
And we never really find out. And I think it's a fantastic exploration of, the play itself is a fascinating exploration of that state of uncertainty. And I think this is a pretty good adaptation.
If we've got heaviosity here, Ty Burr's having fun with the word here, Claudia.
It's a great word. I love it.
But in tough times, isn't fantasy the thing that sells? Or have I got that backwards? Didn't Fred Astaire dance in a top hat in the Depression?
The Depression, that's why, people have always gone to escape a little bit. So I think Ty is right about Slumdog Millionaire in that case. I don't think this is necessarily going to be a huge box office hit, but then you do have Meryl Streep and watching Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman go at it is, it's like watching the best prize fighters or something.
We've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, they who were so famously lovers in Titanic, I think for the first time together again in a movie in Revolutionary Road. Ty, what can you tell us about this one?
This is a film adaptation of a much-loved novel from 1961 by Richard Yates. Mm-hmm. And it is it's in the Updike, malaise and suburbia genre.
1950s, suburban Connecticut.
Yes, exactly. A couple in Connecticut.
Smothered in the burbs.
And it's a beautifully written novel. It just keeps peeling away the layers and layers and layers of meaning and intention and betrayal. It's depressing as hell.
They're watching their dreams go away, their marriage dissolve.
Watching the way they work against each other and eventually, I won't tell you where it ends up. The movie, because it is a movie, can't get into all of those, it can't get into, 75% of the nuances that the book does. The cast, Winslet and DiCaprio, do their best. DiCaprio's character is a lot more simplistic than he is in the book. To me, this movie, this is directed by Sam Mendes, and my joke is that it's American Beauty without the laughs.
sober indeed.
Talk about heaviosity. This to me is the classic white elephant Oscar movie where you go to atone for our suburban sins and come out bearing the weight of the lawns on your shoulders.
But this is not, I'm king of the world.
No. This is the opposite. This is, them getting married and what happened afterwards.
Let's listen to just a little. They had met, when they met, Frank said in Paris, that was the only place to be. In this scene, years later, April suggests that they sell their house and move to Paris so Frank can find himself. And the idea now terrifies him.
What kind of a job could I possibly get?
You won't be getting any kind of a job. Because I will.
Oh, right. Right.
Don't laugh at me. Listen a minute. Do you know what they pay for secretarial positions in government agencies in Europe?
No, I don't.
Listen, Frank, I'm serious about this. Do you think I'm kidding or something?
Okay, I just have a couple of questions is all. For one thing, what exactly am I supposed to be doing while you're out earning all this money?
But don't you see? That's the whole idea. For the first time in your life, you'll have time to find out what it is that you actually want to do.
Titanic lovers, Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet in Revolutionary Road. Claudia, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Ty. I think it's a fantastic novel, and I think that it can't get into the shadings and gradations of that, of Richard Yates' novel. But I really like the supporting part of Michael Shannon, who plays, isn't he great?
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he was the highlight for me. And it's a small part, and I wish he would get noticed because he really, he's emotionally troubled, mentally unstable, but he kind of further destabilizes their marriage, and he just plays this really interesting character that also brings some energy into a fairly contained piece, I think.
Let's get a call from Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to say that I adored a film recently, which is something I don't say often. I'm actually everyone's least favorite movie-going partner because I always nitpick.
Okay.
And I find usually that somebody maybe isn't perfectly cast or all the threads are tied and knotted for us, which I don't much like. But I thought Happy-Go-Lucky, with the possible exception of the title, was pitch perfect in every way. A performance from Sally Hawkins, who typically plays the Bronte heroines, and one reviewer referred to her as the English actress with one of those typically English mouths with teeth that are not certain which direction they want to take.
This is Mike Lee's film, Happy-Go-Lucky. Mm-hmm. We talked to them a few weeks ago right here.
That's the reason I went, because I heard Lee on your show and went, and it's the first time in a couple of years. The last time was Tell No One. I wouldn't have changed a thing. And I feel the same way about this one.
Now, that's funny. I had producers who loved it. I was myself oddly ambivalent. It was so frenetic, some of that happiness, that it was just about shaving my beard if I had one. But it made your top list, and we're glad to hear it. Ty, what did you think? Happy-Go-Lucky.
I think, actually, we're meant to feel ambiguous about her. I mean, this is a movie. It's a very small movie. It's a character study, mm-hmm. really, about one of life's eternal optimists. It's the way this character, Poppy, is wired. And you admire her at the same time that she can drive you absolutely nuts. And in fact, yeah. She drives one of the characters played by Eddie Marsan, who's a world-class cynic, that character. You know, they're like oil and water. And part of the fun of the movie is watching the two of them interact, a pessimist and an optimist.
Let's hear a little something from Cadillac Records. This is the legendary Leonard Chess with Muddy Waters as his first star, built Chess Records in Chicago into a powerhouse label in the 1950s, bringing quote-unquote race music, the rock and roll to you and me, to white audiences. In this scene, Muddy Waters, played by Jeffrey Wright, is in the studio recording 40 Days and 40 Nights. Leonard Chess, Adrian Brody, is talking to an engineer.
Take one.
40 days and 40 nights since my baby left this town.
He's blown out over Muddy's vocals. I gotta cut. Hold on.
Why she left, I just don't know.
Let her ride. We can't record a record with harmonica all over the place.
Yeah, we can.
40 days.
Okay.
And 49.
Sounds good to me, Claudia. You got Mos Def and Beyonce and the classic story of Chess Records in Chicago, Cadillac Records. What did you think?
Well, it sounds good, and that is exactly... I think the music is great. I don't know. It was a flawed biopic, but it has some good performances. I think Jeffrey Wright was really good. I think Mos Def improves the quality of any movies he's in. I just think he's got a great presence. And he wasn't in it long enough. He played Chuck Berry. Beyonce acquitted herself well. She did much better than she did in Dreamgirls, I thought. It was mostly just – it was about the music. I didn't feel like it got deeply enough into the characters. I think there were just too many characters to really get into their stories. And I never got the sense whether Leonard Chess, was – he was exploiting them or whether he really – he did seem to care about them. But it was a little, again, ambiguous about his part.
A little faint praise, I guess we'll characterize that. Time just got a second before yes. The break. What do you say?
Well, I agree with Claudia. The music is tremendous. But here's where the pedant in me and somebody who loves this music comes out. This is a movie about Chess Records, which was founded and run by two brothers, Leonard and Phil Chess. And there's no Phil Chess. They cut him out of the movie entirely. It's only Leonard. That's not right.
Well, let's get a little more of the music here. An earful right here of Beyonce Knowles in Cadillac Records, channeling blues legend Etta James with her classic At Last. We're talking about holiday movies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
To press my cheek to a thrill that I have never known. Oh, yeah. When you smile. Oh, and then the spells cast.
We're talking about the movies and what Hollywood's rolling out for the holidays. Ty Burr is with us, film critic for the Boston Globe. Claudia Puig, film critic for USA Today. Here's a scene from Frost Nixon, the stage play brought to screen where Richard Nixon, former president, disgraced, played by Frank Langella, starts out telling the British interviewer David Frost, Michael Sheen, how hard it was for him to sacrifice his closest aides as his Watergate misdeeds became public. And then he blurts out a bright, shining truth that leaves Frost stunned.
These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I know their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
Frost Nixon, Frank Langella, and Michael Sheen. Ty, what do you think of this one?
I think this is a very entertaining night at the movies that has a wonderful performance by Frank Langella. It's an act of impersonation, but it's an act of impersonation by a skilled, intelligent actor. He takes that sort of shallow caricature that we still have of Tricky Dick, and he deepens it, and he makes it funny and sad. I'm not entirely happy with the way the film plays tricks with the facts. There's an invented late-night phone call from Nixon to Frost that serves as sort of the movie's dramatic fulcrum, and that never happened. And that sort of bothers me. And some of the ways they transpose what was said in the interviews themselves, which is a matter of public record, dealing with the greatest political crisis in American history, that doesn't entirely – that particular line, when the president does it, mm-hmm. it's not illegal, did not take place at that – in that particular part of the interview. It took place a lot earlier when they were talking not about Watergate but about something else
did
entirely.
Did the stage play take the same liberty, or this is Ron Howard doing this?
No,
in the film?
The stage play took the same liberties, but I think that there's – a stage play, especially one that is done not realistically as that staging was, has a certain a leeway.
License.
To, well, license, really? Exactly. Mm-hmm. To
that films don't?
Films,
really?
Especially because they're of
forever?
Their greater verisimilitude.
Mm-hmm.
Of their,
I see.
The way they present yep. things yep. as if this is the way it happened.
Yep.
And this movie ostensibly says this is the way it happened. I don't think it's playing quite fair with the facts.
Claudia, listening there, I have not seen this, but listening to Frank Langella there, I mean, it's wonderful in a way, but it's also a little campier than I would have thought the Nixon. If it's
not, if you see it,
okay, good.
Yeah, I don't think it comes across campy. It's an amazing performance, mm-hmm. and he gives it his own spin. He doesn't obviously look like Nixon, so mm-hmm. there's a scene. I think I liked it better than Ty, and I get his points. I just think Peter Morgan is a great screenwriter. He wrote the play as well, and he wrote The Queen. I really like. I think he's a really smart screenwriter, and I'd like to see more of his work. But there's a great scene where he comes out of the very last interview, and I'm sure this is invented as well, but he goes up to a woman who's holding a dog, and he pets this. It's a dachshund. And he says, "Oh, what's that dog called? And mm-hmm. is that a dog? What they call a dachshund?" And then he kind of tugs on his ear, and he pets it awkwardly. Mm. And it kind of captures how he was so uncomfortable in his own skin.
That's not invented, by the way. That actually happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
The president
okay.
who wore his wingtip shoes on the beach. Not exactly.
Right.
I've got a little tape here from the director of Frost Nixon, Ron Howard. This is from a publicity interview, explaining that when he saw Frost Nixon on the stage, he was struck both because of what it meant then in its time and what it means today.
I was connecting it to the Bush administration being at war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the you know, the alleged abuses of power that were being discussed constantly. And this story reminds me that something that I thought would never really happen in this country again has in fact occurred, and that is a sort of a breakdown in the citizens' trust of its government.
Claudia, did you see Frost Nixon as contemporary commentary?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily. I mean, obviously, W was trying to be more direct commentary,
yeah.
and I don't think it succeeded, but. Yes, I think so. You know, those of us who lived through that time kind of, you know, look for the verisimilitude of the situation. And there's a lot of stuff that I see that sort of, you know, has its kind of resonance with what's going on or what has gone on. But I saw it more as just this great interplay between these two very unlikely characters. And I thought it was they were both very well developed. Michael Sheen was just almost as good as Frank Langella. And I think he's another really underappreciated, undersung actor. He was Tony Blair in The Queen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think he's great as David
Frost. Yeah, that
Frost.
Was a great performance.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it. Let me get a call from Andover, Massachusetts, and Bernard. Bernard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, if I can go back for a moment to when you were commenting on common themes.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I must confess I haven't seen all these movies, but all these movies do seem to have one common theme in a almost nostalgia with the idea of, you know, Benjamin Button and Australia starting out in the past,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then moving forward to almost after World War II with Cadillac Records, Milk, Nixon and Frost. And especially with that comment you just had by the director of Nixon Frost, the idea of connecting that to the United States now and the Bush administration, is there some kind of an almost a nostalgic look or a fixation in the industry today?
Let us pick it up, Bernard. Ty, what about it? We've got wartime Australia, Milk in the 70s, Nazis, Nixon, Benjamin Button way back in the World War I. I don't know. Is history nostalgia on the march?
I think the film industry, by which I mean the studios, the American film industry has learned to their distress that Iraq war movie dramas don't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that they make these movies with important themes, but they want people to go see them. And I think that they're easier and more digestible when they're set in the past. This is one reason there are so many movies about the Nazis, you know, because they'll always be bad.
We know the framework. We're ready to go.
They'll always be bad. They'll never be not bad.
Yep.
You know, except mm-hmm. in Valkyrie, where you have a couple of good ones, but still.
Trying to kill Hitler.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
I think the past is reliable in a way, in a marketable way, and also in a storytelling way, in a way that the present is not.
I wonder if there comes a point at which we start, though, to deal with the troubles we're in right now, which are very present.
Well, Gran Torino kind of does in a way, and it's, you know, the present is depicted in a way that is pretty unpleasant in the sense, or not unpleasant, but it's like difficult and hard to absorb the changing nature of our world.
This is so Clint Eastwood. Tell us the story in Gran Torino, Claudia.
He's a retired auto worker, and he's living in, I guess, the suburb of Detroit, and he was also a Korean War vet. He's an extremely bigoted guy. His wife has just died. That seems to have been one of the few bright spots in his life. He has a really bad relationship with his kids, who he feels kind of take advantage of him and don't understand him, and he just grouses and grumps about the changing nature of his neighborhood. He's got these Hmong, I don't know how to pronounce it, Hmong, I guess
yeah.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Immigrants that moved
next door. Southeast Asian, Laotian, maybe,
yes.
Mountain people.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, and they explain that in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And his first reaction, of course, is to complain about how the neighborhood's changed. I think he's of Polish extraction. But eventually he forms this friendship with him. But at first it seems like an extreme portrayal in terms of his discrimination, his biases and his mm-hmm. sort of prejudicial kind of outlook. But
they end up with Dirty Harry on their side.
Yes.
In effect.
It's a lot more. Well, I'm sorry.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that from the trailer of Clint Eastwood's. And he says this is his last time in front of the camera on the screen. We'll see. But here's from Gran Torino. Eastwood plays Walt Kowalski, retired auto worker in a rundown neighborhood in Detroit.
Come here, girl.
Stop! Let go!
What you looking at, old man?
Ever knows how you come across somebody once in a while you shouldn't have messed with? That's me.
Are you crazy, man? Get out of here, man.
What the hell these Chinese have to move in this neighborhood for?
Ty, it sounds like the ghost of Dirty Harry. Does he still have the menace going
on? Well, I mean, but that's the idea governing this movie. Old Dirty Harry trying to function mm-hmm. in a modern, multiracial world. And that idea is fascinating in theory,
mm-hmm.
More fascinating in theory, I think, than the movie plays out in fact. Eastwood's performance in this is very cartoonish. At some points, he literally growls like a pit bull.
Yeah, he really does. Those growls got on my nerves after a while.
I know. It happens more. And it's a very a lot of the characters are, especially his family members, are very thinly drawn. It's working with archetypes. It's trying to be a populist realist movie, which is very hard to do. And there are points when I felt like I was laughing at the movie. There are points where I felt very sympathetic with what he was trying to do. It's a fascinating movie to talk about.
Let's hear from Therese on just this point, Claudia, and I'll come to you. Therese in Lansing, Michigan. Therese, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Hi. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for all of you. Like the caller before, the woman who said that she went out and watched a movie because it had been reviewed on NPR, I do the same thing with movies and books, and I'm wondering how you go about sorting out what you say and how that affects the different actors and directors. If you particularly like a certain director, and you know that there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of us who are going to make decisions and choices based on some of what you all are saying, do you ever feel guilty, or how do you keep your own affection or admiration for a performer in check when you're reviewing?
Well, that's interesting. We've got critics here. I mean, Claudia, presumably you don't pull punches. That's your job, or do you?
Well, she raises an interesting question. I mean, obviously our job is not to be objective. We are supremely subjective, but
That's what they pay you for in your role.
Exactly.
That's what they want.
It pays to be interestingly subjective.
Yes.
Exactly. But you want to not – there are certain directors whose work you admire a lot because of the sort of the body of their work, and that you want to not let that sway you too much to, you know, think, okay, well, I like Clint Eastwood. I loved Letters from Iwo Jima, so, you know, cut him some slack on this one. I think sometimes I wish when I was watching a film that I didn't know who it was directed by, that I knew nothing about it. I could go into it completely cold, and that's impossible. But it's the same goes for actors. There are certain, you know, actors that you think are just, you know, better than others, and that's part of the whole process. So I don't think we can think about what that's their feelings, though. I mean, that's
right.
Something we can't think.
Let it rip, subjective and interesting. I mean, my situation is a little different because I'm maybe talking directly with the director. I certainly am not going to enthuse about it if I'm not crazy about it, but I'll still ask that director a lot of questions. We're talking about nostalgia, but also films set more in the moment, sort of more now. There's one called Wendy and Lucy. Not such a big one, but here's a bit from the trailer. It's the story of a young woman, played by Michelle Williams, who sets off for Alaska with her dog, Lucy, to start a new life. Here she's standing by a bonfire with a group of runaways.
Great dog. What's her name?
Lucy.
Your sweetheart, Lucy.
Where are you going?
Going to Alaska.
Woohoo! King salmon! You going to work?
Ty, this is nowhere in the past. I guess this is pretty much now. She's not in Alaska. They're somewhere in Oregon, Washington. I don't know.
Washington State, I believe.
Oregon.
This is
it's
a movie.
Oregon.
Yeah,
okay.
Oregon. I stand corrected. Yeah. It's a movie very much of the moment, with its, you know, fingers right on the pulse of what is happening in this country right now. It's about average people falling through the cracks in a way that's not pedantic, in a way that plays, for the most part, very naturally. It's a very, very small movie with a heartbreaking performance by Michelle Williams, by the director of Old Joy, which was a similar sort of movie. It's, you know, not a lot of people are going to see it, but it rings very, very true.
And tells a story of now in that what? It's not clear where these people are going. They're kind of up in the air.
Well, that's
one
of the... Claudia.
You don't know her backstory, but that is exactly – she's on – somehow you know that she's hit hard times, and she's trying to find a job in Alaska where she's heard that there are opportunities. And all these – a series of things befall her that don't seem huge in and of themselves, but they eventually do become this sort of life-changing experience for her. But it's also – it's a really – I agree with Ty. It's really small, and it's – a fantastic performance, and it is just about a sort of an average person. There's nothing glamorous about her, nothing even particularly interesting about her. She and her dog are traveling, and she loves her dog.
On the road with the dog. Let's go from small to big. Here's that trailer for Australia. Lady Sarah Ashley Nicole Kidman, talk about big, telling the young half-caste child Nula, played by Brandon Walters, a bedtime story. The metaphors run wild.
Would you like to hear a story?
What story?
Well, there's a girl, and there's a sort of magic man, and there's a big, like a storm.
Japan sweeps the South Pacific, heading toward Australia.
Anyway, the story takes place in a, far faraway land called Oz.
A lot of timpani, a lot of big time in this one. Ty, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Welcome to Baz Luhrmann land. This is, his attempt to out Moulin Rouge, and bring it all back home to his home country of Australia. You know, this is a movie that, well, for one thing, I joked in my review, this is a movie that comes with its own sequel. It's almost 3 hours long, and literally the first half of it, more than the first half, is a cattle drive western set in Australia, and then there's this pause, and literally almost the curtain comes down. You take a bathroom break and come back, and we're on World War II with the bombing of Darwin.
We've got it
all. It feels like the movie's trying to do too much. Actually, the first part is a pretty decent Western, Australian Western, but then it just keeps going and going and going. And this is actually sort of the kind of artificial movie that feels really like not the kind of film we want to see at this point in time.
Claudia, what about you? Ready to roll with it anyway or no?
No, this is the one I probably like the least of all the holiday movies. And you know who co-wrote it was Stuart Beatty, who wrote Pirates of the Caribbean. So that's kind of telling you all you need to know. it's a pretty melodramatic exercise in tedium, I thought.
Well, on that note, not exactly high holiday cheer. We'll go out a little music here from, what have we got? Oh, Saya from Slumdog Millionaire. It's been a great tour of the horizon. We thank you both for it. Claudia Puig with USA Today in Pasadena, California. Claudia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was fun.
And Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe. Always great to see you, Ty. Happy holidays.
Likewise, Tom. Thank you. Happy holidays to you, too.
To everybody. We'll go out with a little of that Slumdog Millionaire soundtrack. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy viewing. This is On Point.